This is Setting the Record Straight. And I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. And we're brought to you on BreadboxMedia.com, especially for you. How you been doing? I hope everything's fine. You know, though, most of my life I've been very misinformed about what went on in the Iberian Peninsula under Muslim domination. I wonder if you have. About what really went on in the Iberian Peninsula, Spain, France, Portugal. During those 700 years, it was dominated by the Muslims. There's a great myth that has great currency among the academics of our world. That period in place was an Andalusian paradise. Well, what's the truth about that? That's what I want to set the record straight about. Perhaps you've heard me talk before about the Black Legend. The Black Legend is the anti-Catholic slander mainly propagated by the British Empire after Henry VIII began the British version of the Protestant Reformation, an activity that really needs to be called the Protestant deformation of the original inheritance of Christ that came to us through the Catholic Church. The Protestant Reformation or deformation in England did many things. The one thing it certainly did was impoverish the common man who had depended upon the vast networks of monasteries as schools, highly benign and humane landlords, and universities and sources of medical care and charity. When that was removed from the British people, they fell into the poverty they were so familiar with in the descriptions of Charles Dickens centuries later. That did not exist when the monasteries, which had been there for 1,100 years, and represented a social safety net for the common man. These legions of fine monks even produced the English landscape, so beautiful and so often depicted, and through 1,100 years of labor, produced the beautiful English countryside and villages that we see today. They created it out of rather ugly wastelands, but it was stolen from them by Henry VIII. But that's another story. That's another aspect of the Black Legend. The Black Legend is basically a distortion lens, a British distortion lens, of our view of ourselves as Catholics. Please don't mistake me. We're ordered by Christ in the Grand Commission to save souls, and it's vital that we do save souls. And our evangelization would be crippled unless we corrected these misapprehensions. I've run into young people that says, oh, the Catholic Church has such a violent history. Well, in proportion, it is most unviolent compared to what was going on elsewhere. And that's still true of most of the modern scandals in the Catholic Church. We always have bad Catholics. My gosh, of the first 12, 8% were corrupt. That's Judas, and Christ hired him. So let's not beat ourselves up too much when we have a bad Catholic or a bad priest or a bad nun. We all fall and must rise again. But to be effective in our evangelization, to save souls, we must have clear 2020 vision of what the Catholic Church represented by the virtuous and humane and charitable lives of Catholics through history. We need to see the Catholic Church as glorious as it really is. The Catholic Church represents many things, including it is the vestments of Christ on earth, still on earth, daily, physically present, in the body and blood. Too few understand that. We ought to have signs out front of our churches. Come inside. Join us. Christ is actually here. He's actually physically present here, and he will touch you. He will touch his physical body to your physical body. His physical body will become part of your physical body. He will enter your blood with his blood. Christ has an intimate spousal relationship with Catholics. That is what is distinct about the Catholic Church. That is our greatest tool in evangelization, the Eucharist, the real meaning of the Eucharist. And a distorted lens on history will only blind people from seeing that for what it is. And a very clear lens allow us to see the Catholic Church and Catholics, the great majority of Catholics through history, for what they really were, which is grace-filled and God-haunted. And we need to become aware of that. So we very badly need to set the record straight about the Black Legend. We need to take it apart piece by piece and show it for what it is. In the distorted spirit of our times, in the dismembered zeitgeist, it is very important that if we are to save souls, one of the most important first steps is to start there with revealing the true history and misconceptions about the Catholic Church and its history. So we're going to take it up part by part. Today we're going to talk about the truth of what really went on with women in the treatment of women in Islamic Spain, despite what the British would like us to believe, followed by over three centuries of cruel oppression, really genocide against the Irish Catholics, for the reason that Catholics were considered to be non-loyal, because they had an alternative ruler, because they had an alternative and perhaps more powerful allegiance to Christ's Catholic Church, something that King Henry VIII and especially his daughter Elizabeth could not abide. And the story of their cruelty needs to be better known. Of course we need to forgive, and we do forgive. But we must not forget. If we do forget, then we will adopt the distorted lens of our own selves and think that the Catholics of our history are less than they were. To Catholics in the United States, this is of paramount importance, because despite the fact that we had to fight a war to free ourselves from British domination, the anti-Catholicism that is implicit in the histories that is taught in our schools and dominates the volumes in our libraries continually needs to be set straight again. The Black Legend is composed of many parts. One of the parts is the absurd exaggerations about the Spanish Inquisition, which was actually the most humane and advanced court in Europe at the time, especially more advanced than what Elizabeth was doing to Catholics in England. Another aspect of the Black Legend concerns the seven centuries that of Muslim domination of the Iberian Peninsula, of Catholic France and Catholic Spain and Catholic Portugal, went on uninterruptedly, 700 years, more than 700 years. Basically, the story we've been told is upside down. I know my friend who graduated from Oxford and has a master's from Oxford was taught that the Muslim knight was superior to the Catholic knight. Yet any examination of reliable historic sources shows much the reverse to be the case, especially with respect to the treatment of women, which is our subject today, one small aspect of our mistaken understanding of the period in which Spain was ruled by Muslims. That ended in 1492, when Ferdinand and Isabella drove the last Muslims out of Spain. It's something as Catholics that we need to better understand, to really understand the great gift of the Catholic ethos that Christ left us. And he left us in persona Christi, in the persons of our priesthood, to lift our behavior toward our fellow man and toward women especially. So that's the subject of this program, is that aspect of the Black Legend which we've been taught, so carefully taught, in the words of Rodgers and Hammerstein's song for South Pacific. You have to be carefully taught these prejudices. It's late in my life that I've discovered how much history that I've taught is simply not true. We're a very fortunate era of a broad-based and highly diverse media in which many voices can be heard. And the truth about the real glorious history of the Catholic Church is being showered upon us, and I try to bring you small pieces of that. There's an amazing new book by Dario Fernandez Moreira. This man is a great and renowned scholar in this area, and there's great praise for its myth-busting, its debunking the myths that have so long dominated Islamic historiography and conventional wisdom. We've been waiting for this great breakthrough to come to light, and the author, Fernando Moreras, has done it. He's examined the underside of Islamic Spain, a civilization usually considered a model of dynamism and vigor. Through the study of primary sources, he questions the intellectual view of the superiority of that civilization. The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise, that's the name of the book, will certainly prompt people to reevaluate what they think about Islamic Spain. It was not a harmonious locus of tolerance. In fact, it was dominated by cultural repression and marginalization, and was quite a violent and uncomfortable place for a Jew or Catholic to inhabit. This has been a desperately needed myth-busting to counter the mythology that pervades academia on this subject. How widespread is this mistake in academia? Well, you'd be surprised. I'm going to concentrate on one particular area from the book, that of women in Islamic Spain and how they were treated. It's of particular interest. Let's start out with a quote from our president, President Barack Obama in his speech at Cairo University in June 4th, 2009. President Obama said this,
Islam has a proud tradition of tolerance.
We see it in the history of Andalusia and Cordoba during the Inquisition. Likewise, it is important for Western countries to avoid impeding Muslim citizens from practicing religion as they see fit. For instance, by dictating what clothes a Muslim woman should wear, we can't disguise hostility towards any religion behind the pretense of liberalism. Another quote, this time from a Republican, a prominent presidential candidate, Carly Farina, former Hewlett-Packard CEO, and when she appeared with Bill Maher on HBO's Real Time, January 9, 2015, she said, "The truth is, at the time of the great caliphates, the center of the Muslim world was highly tolerant." So we see quotes like this all over the place. The record really needs to be set straight. So here's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, David Levering Lewis. He says, "In the Middle Ages, there emerged two Europes, one Muslim Europe, secure in its defenses, religiously tolerant, and maturing in cultural and scientific sophistication. The others, the Catholic Empire, an area of unceasing warfare, in which superstition passed for religion, and the flame of knowledge sputtered weakly." End of quote. Oh my, what terrible people we Catholics are. I'll do a small bit of straightening some of that out after the break. This is BreadboxMedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin, trying in my small way to save souls.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
Back after the break on BreadboxMedia.com, I'm Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight about the plight of women in Islamic Spain during those more than seven centuries that Muslims ruled the Iberian Peninsula. Just before the break, we quoted David Levering Lewis, a scholar that's quoted widely, although when you read the reviews of responsible historians of his books, you wonder why. Because his anti-Catholic bias distorts his findings. But in any event, this is what he said about that period in that place. Just before the break, I read it. Here it is again. He says, "In the Middle Ages, there emerged two Europes, one Muslim Europe, secure in its defenses, religiously tolerant, and maturing in cultural and scientific sophistication. The others, the Catholic Empire, an area of unceasing warfare, in which superstition passed for religion, and the flame of knowledge sputtered weakly." Well, the reverse is true, actually. And this needs to be set straight. This is a lot of our approach to our modern world is influenced by the past. I've always quoting a Catholic author who said, "You can't ignore the past. It's not even past, because we live with its results." Here's the Oxford Encyclopedia of the Modern Islamic World in an article written by Brett Briner and Christian Troll, called Christianity and Islam. It says, "On the intellectual level, Islam played an important role in the development of Western European civilization by passing on both the philosophy of Aristotle and its own scientific, technological, and philosophical tradition. Religious tolerance remained a part of the Islamic law, although its application varied with social, political, and economic circumstances." Even Tony Blair said, during his terms as Prime Minister of Great Britain, in an article he wrote in Foreign Affairs 2007, "The standard bearers of tolerance in the early Middle Ages were far more likely to be found in Muslim lands than in Christian ones." And Tony Blair is a convert to Catholicism. These are distinguished people. What really distinguishes their quotes that I've just offered you is they're entirely false. These are good people that believe a carefully constructed myth about the truth of the relationship between Catholics and Muslims during the years Muslims dictated what occurred in Spain and Andalusia. How did we get it so wrong? Well, I'll examine that toward the end of the program. I'll theorize on it. Well, let's come back to women in Islamic Spain, and we're going to cover the areas of stoning, veils, sexual slavery, even female circumcision. Actually, in depicting Islamic Spain as a model of tolerance and multiculturalism, scholars have attempted to show that Muslim women in Al-Andalus, enjoyed a surprising degree of freedom, especially with compared with women in Catholic lands at the same time. But like so much else about Islamic Spain, the claim does not hold up to be true when one scrutinizes it. We're going to examine the actual Islamic teachings and practicing in medieval Spain. According to the Maliki school of Islamic jurisprudence that dominated this Muslim realm for most of its century. Let's take the matter of stoning. The scholarly histories of Islamic Spain have not talked about the cultural practice of stoning a female musan. That's a free Muslim of sane mind who's married properly and has had sexual intercourse with a spouse in a proper way. Free, married, Andalusian Muslim women were supposed to enjoy sex fully, but within the confines of marriage structures. And Muslim men were supposed to enjoy sex only with their wives or sexual slaves. Therefore, according to the Maliki legal texts and manuals, sexual intercourse of a Muslim woman outside marriage constituted fornication and was punishable with public stoning to death. If a woman was a musan, as an alternative to stoning, there was a minimum of 80 publicly administered lashes plus exile for a year. Thus, if we read in Maliki's Muswata that an adulterous Mushan woman must be stoned, although this legal treatise thoughtfully takes into account the possibility that the woman may be pregnant, in which case her stoning must wait until the baby has been weaned. Here's the actual text. Listen to it. Maliki's Muwata prudently exists. According to the Messenger of Allah's teaching, a pregnant woman must not be stoned until she has given birth and suckled the baby sufficiently. And this is from the actual source. That was a period of about 2 years. So, Maliki's Risalat confirms the Islamic teaching and explains the term Musan in these two citations. And here it is, chapter 37, verse 21. Illicit intercourse. Zina. If a freeborn Muslim who has been married commits adultery or fornication, he or she must be stoned to death. What is meant by musan is a man who has married a woman properly and has had sexual intercourse with her in a proper way, or a woman who has married a man properly and has had sexual intercourse with him in a proper way. Chapter 37, verse 22. But if he or she has not been a musan, he or she is beaten 100 lashes and then banished to another town, where he or she must be in prison for a year. A slave who commits adultery or fornication is to be beaten 50 lashes. A slave woman is to be treated likewise, even if she is married. Besides, male slaves who fornicate are not exiled, nor is a slave woman exiled. So this confirms that the punishment for adultery in the case of a Musan woman must be stoning, and then no pit need be dug for the punishment. So that is in the matter of stoning. The second of the four items that we're going to discuss at the start of this program in treatment of women under Islam is the matter of veiling. As a matter of fact, that needs to be straightened out. A lot of historians of this era and Spanish Arabists are a bit mistaken and copy each other in their mistakes about the true status and behavior of women in Al-Andalusia. One scholar, Maria Luisa Avila, anxious to correct this, says this. She points out that the behavior that is partially free, that is attributed in their history to Muslim women, is actually the behavior of slave women in Andalusia. As a matter of fact, the common mistake is that the behaviors of slave women has been used by scholars of Islamic studies and by medievalist historians to be representative of the relative freedom or relaxed role of women in Andalusius compared to the rest of the Islamic world. Well, these are not representative because the slave woman's legal status and social situation were wholly different from those of the Hura, the free woman. Therefore, cannot be considered typical of the Andalusi women in any way. And this is a point that many commentators and historians and writers have missed. In the book, The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise, the author gives a particular case as an example. Gives this case as an example. It's a legal case. And the protagonist, a woman and three males, one of them is a legal counselor. The jurist was highly regarded as a legal counselor by a certain type of person, quote, by the veiled woman who stayed in their houses and belonged to families of good birth, unquote. This sentence indicates the proper practice for a respectable woman staying in her house and being veiled when going out in public. But the narrative continues from there. A Muslim scholar brings his wife and son to the famous faqih. This is the story. Quote, I went to see him to ask for a certified testimony regarding my wife and my son. It had to be arranged in such a way that the woman could give the testimony. So this is how they went about it. Once the alim had been seated, the faqih asked the son, still a child, to sit down as well. But he does not ask the woman to sit down. Then the faqih turns to the son and points to the standing woman and asks the son, who is that one? The child answers, that is my mother. The faqih then proceeds to write down the certified testimony that the woman then was allowed to relate to him. The episode ends with the alim expressing satisfaction with the way the faqih handled the case. The episode illuminates the condition of a female Musan in Andalusis. Although she could have titled the property, inherited, and received it as dowry, she needed a man as an agent, and in this case the husband, in order to engage in legal transactions, as Maliki Islamic law prescribed. Moreover, the woman was not asked to sit in the presence of men. She remained standing, unlike the men. The woman could not speak for herself and needed a male, even if he was her child, to speak for her. And there was no need for a testimony from her. And there was no need for testimony from her male child to ascertain that that was his mother. A woman, because she wore a face veil, was unrecognizable. Indeed, a woman must not walk in the company of a man except one she would be legally forbidden to marry, such as a very close relative. And she must not walk alone, but only in the company of other women. A woman must not come out in public unless moved by necessity, such as attending the funeral ceremonies of her parents or near relatives, or occasions of a similar nature, which are lawful to her. Well, are you wondering what kind of ceremonies were lawful for a Muslim woman in Islamic Spain to attend? Well, here's a brief idea. She must not attend a funeral ceremony at which a professional mourner screams. Nor is it lawful for her to attend ceremonies where clarinets or lutes or similar musical instruments were played. However, she is permitted to attend weddings where tambourines are played. I've just been quoting 41.07. Here's another restriction. This one is a restriction on men looking at women. It is incumbent upon Muslims to avoid looking at women who are strangers to them. 40.6. So other legal texts prescribe that a Musan woman must be veiled whenever she leaves her house, and that she can leave her house only with a husband's permission and only for absolutely urgent reasons. We have examples from different centuries and social levels that indicate the sheltered status of Muslim free women in Islamic Spain. We're approaching a break, and once again on the strains of Tarega's beautiful guitar piece played by Pepe Romero, Recuerdos de la Alhambra, we step aside for these messages.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Box Media, I'm Chuck Coughlin back again talking about the condition that women lived under in Islamic Spain, Catholic women and Muslim women and slave women. So, I was giving some examples of how women were humbled and had less than third or fourth class status. So let's step on together. How about another interesting example? From the record in Cordoba, a 9th century conversation between a minister, Muhammad Masir, and a literary scholar, Abul il-Hakam. To a grammatical question from the literary scholar regarding the proper feminine form of an Arabic verb in the imperative, if it were used hypothetically to order a woman to attack. Yes, to order a woman to attack, to go to war. Masir answers, "Oh, Abu al-Hakim, I have never heard a question more detestable than the one you pose. Allah orders women to stay in their house, and you want to know how to order her to go to war." This example shows how keeping Muslim women away from public places was part of the ethos of the Umayyad court and considered to have religious sanctions. Of course, the faces were covered from the eyes down, but the heads were also covered and the bodies wrapped in ample robes. And this was a stark contrast to Catholic women. In the court of the same Alfonso X, these women are depicted with faces uncovered and bodies unwrapped.
There were women permitted to go about in gorgeous clothes with loose hair. Who were they? They were sexual slave girls, most usually kidnapped Catholic women.
The Mushana would wear the proper head and body dress. Many, many documents attest to this difference. Slave girls might have elegant attire and golden jewelry, but not the Muslim women. Women were even forbidden to loosen their hair when cleaning it.
While taking a bath.
It was sufficient to throw water on the hair and rub the water into the scalp with the hands. In fact, Spanish jurisprudence advised proper Muslim women to keep their hair short. This is from another legal text, quote, "The sunnah for women is to shorten their hair.
It is disliked for her to shave, and it is said to be harmful.
Because it is mutilation. She shortens her hair. The basis for that is what the Prophet said, women do not have to shave. Women shorten their hair, 28.14b.
Andalusian Muslim women were not allowed to play around in a swimming pool, even fully dressed, as some imaginative Western academics fancy today. Al-Tafri made clear that women could not go to public baths, no matter how fully dressed, except in case of a bleeding illness or some other necessity that was dire. There's a legal manual with a long title. It was written in 1492, that prescribes similar restrictions. Quote, "A Muslim wife can be allowed to see those relatives whom she could not have married if she were single, and to go to the mosque during the day and to places that are beyond suspicion, and to have fun with other women with whom there are no men, but only during the day and only once a week." End of quote. It is significant that these laws were used by Muslims in territory already reconquered by the Christians, where Christian women's had much easier access to the public sphere. The scholar Malik praised Muhammad's youngest wife, Aisha, for veiling herself even for blind men. He wrote, "Aisha, may Allah be pleased with her, veiled herself in the presence of a blind man. Someone said, 'He can't see you.' She said, 'But I can see him.'" Well, we have to note that human nature being as variable as it is, that there were some rulers at Taifa, much liked by many scholars as proof of the enlightenment of Al-Andalus, who were somewhat lax about these rules, but this was not considered a virtue in the eyes of the population at large. This laxity among the rulers affected the custom of wearing the face veil among women in the royal courts. As has been observed, the question of the seclusion of Muslim women in Al-Andalus is counterintuitive. In medieval Maliki Islamic law and practice, higher socioeconomic status actually conferred less autonomy and power in the public arena. This is what Western scholars generally regard as freedom. Conversely, the lower social esteem and class of a woman, the less strict was her seclusion and segregation from society at large. So a Muslim woman's status depended on the status of her husband or father or master in the case of a concubine, a female sexual slave. Now, some scholars ascribe this practice of veiling to the influence of the Catholic Greek Roman Empire, Byzantium, after Islam's military conquest of the Christian Middle East in the 7th century. But that's not right. Veiling derived from the interpretation right and wrong of Quranic verses, and perhaps also from Bedouin customs. The evidence from paintings and documents indicates that the Muslim veiling of all adult women outside their home or in the presence of men, not their immediate relatives,
could not have been an imitation of the practices of the Catholic Greek-Roman Empire.
Because in the empire, Greek women did not normally cover their faces with a veil or anything else.
There's a lot of artworks and portraits depicting Catholic Greek empresses,
some of whom ruled the empire on their own.
Portraits of them show abundant hair under their royal crowns and jewelry.
They wore their hair uncovered, piled high, one quote, structured and castellated with layers of ropes and interwoven locks. Now, older women, perhaps widowed or maybe married, might wear a veil over their heads in public, but not in their houses, even in the presence of men other than their husbands. There's a medieval Greek manuscript that has illustrations from the 12th century that depicts a Greek Orthodox ceremony, a marriage ceremony, with a royal woman sitting and displaying her hair down to the neck, with only a diadem around her temples. Upper-class women participated in mixed reception of men and women. The Empress Irene followed her husband Alexios I on campaigns. Other imperial wives or daughters ruled cities in the 14th century. Aristocratic ladies held literary salons and freely consorted with men in the 11th century, as in the 12th and the 14th. Anna Koneni, with her circle of intellectuals who discussed philosophy, is a prime example. There's a lot of other examples.
And what about the public baths?
Well, the Byzantine culture emphasized the enjoyment of bathing, and in the early Catholic Greek Roman Empire, there were co-ed baths. In Constantinople alone, there were 9 large public baths and 153 private baths in the 5th century. The early church's acceptance of baths as a natural part of life continued to influence everyone's behavior, and there were even monastic baths in the late empire. So this Catholic society was one in which, in the right circumstances, a woman could be well-educated and even quite learned. All aristocratic ladies received a good education. We even have literary works by these people, medical manuals by these women. You have to contrast this relative openness to women's public roles with the Muslim practice in Al-Andalus of allowing a man to see the hair of a woman other than his wife, or a slave girl, only under very precise circumstances. According to their legal documents, if even part of the hair of the woman comes out from under her veil during her prayer, she must restart the prayer. Now, these are restrictions, but there are more serious things that lie ahead in our consideration of the subject, such as female sexual slavery in Al-Andalus. In Maliki jurisprudence, a slave girl, either bought at the marketplace or captured in war, with whom her master had sex, became his sexual slave, or concubine. The term is jarida. Al-Andalus became a center for the trade and distribution of slaves. Who were these slaves? Well, there were different groups. There were young female slaves, sometimes as young as 11 years old. There were male children who had been castrated to become eunuchs in the harems. There were other male children brought up in barracks to be slave warriors. There were even male children to be used as the sexual playthings of the powerful and wealthy. There were men used as servants or workers. For every conceivable use, human beings of all ages and races were bought and sold. What about the price of a slave? Well, the price of a slave depended on his or her race, sex, age, abilities. White slaves, especially blonde ones, often captured in raids of Catholic lands, were the most prized.
In case you're asking the question, well, didn't the Catholics have a lot of slaves too? Well, the answer is no. In the early 400s, in the Roman Empire, once we had Catholic emperors, starting with Constantine, slavery was forbidden. The famous French archivist of the Bibliothèque Nationale and historian, Régine Pernod, P-E-R-N-O-U-D, has amply documented that, and I've covered that in other programs. Slave owners among Catholic Europeans were extremely rare for many centuries until the discovery of the New World. And after the fall of the empire, it was not a widespread practice. It was very unusual for a Catholic to be a slave owner. This was a direct result of the influence of Catholicism.
It cripples our thoughts that it's not widely understood, that the Renaissance brought up return to Roman law and reduced again the status of women that had been elevated to quite a high degree under the influence of the Catholic Church. So what about the 17th and 18th century and all the slaves in the European colonies in North America? Well, they needed workers for the plantations, in the British colonies especially, in order to staff the plantations of the British colonists in the New World. There's a very sad fact, and not widely known, that in the 17th century, 80% of the immigrants to the area that is now the United States were slaves. 80% of the immigrants were slaves. And another unknown fact wrapped within that unknown fact is this, is that they were Irish Catholic slaves for the most part. There was white slavery. Most of the slaves in the 17th century in North America were white slaves, usually Irish Catholics. We'll return after the break. This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight on breadboxmedia.com.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
We're back together again. This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight on breadboxmedia.com. We're talking about the fate of women who lived in Al-Andalus, the Iberian Peninsula, during the more than seven centuries that Catholic Spain, Portugal, and France were ruled by Muslim rulers. We're now talking about slaves. In the year 912, during the Islamic Golden Age, so-called, the price for a male black slave was 200 coins of silver. However, a black girl from Libya went for 300 dinars of gold. A white girl without education cost 1,000 dinars of gold. A white girl with singing ability cost 14,000 dinars. To give you an idea about this, in Al-Rahman III's court, there were 3,750 slaves. His harem had 6,300 women, and his army included 13,750 slave warriors. A document from the 12th century tells of the tricks used by sellers of slaves in the Muslim slave markets. They would put ointments on slave girls of a darker complexion to whiten their faces. Brunettes were placed for 4 hours in a solution to make them blonde. Ointments were placed on the face and body of black slaves to make them more attractive. The merchant painted red the tips of the fingers of a white slave. He painted in gold those of a black slave, and he dressed them all in transparent clothes, the white female slaves in pink and the black ones in yellow and red. There's a 13th century document, a letter, Abu Bakr, that shows how a respectable Muslim man in Al-Andalus would regard a sexual slave girl as a source of, quote, love. The poetry of one 12th century writer is a good example of this, of what these scholars call delightful Andalusian love poetry that so many Western scholars have praised, oblivious to its sordid cultural context. That these poems are about sexual slave girls, not about the secluded Huras or Osanas, the wives of Al-Andalus, who went about covered from head to toe. In the Islamic world, harems, which were not a Catholic institution, contrary to what is sometimes written, there were no harems in the Catholic, Greek, and Roman Empire. These harems swarmed with female captives from foreign lands, white women from Persia, Kurdistan, from Catholic Greek Roman Empire, from Catholic Spain and Armenia, darker ones from Ethiopia, Sudan, and India. Harun al-Rashid had 1,000 sexual slaves. Another man had 4,000. Another, more than 6,000. There's a Moroccan writer, Fatima Mernissi, who wrote this. The harems became places of the greatest luxury,
where the most beautiful women in the world played their cultural differences and mastery of diverse skills and knowledge like winning cards
for seducing caliphs.
In order to seduce these men,
one had to dazzle them in the fields that fascinated them, in astrology, in mathematics, in history. On top of these, even more important was poetry and song. Pretty girls who got lost in serious conversations had no chance to be noticed, and even less chance to last. And the favorites, who knew this very well, surrounded themselves with competent teachers. If these sexually skilled girls succeeded in becoming favorites of their masters, they themselves could have servants. Some ingenious academic specialists have argued that by permitting slave girls to learn skills that increased their attractiveness in the eyes of their masters and granted them relatively greater freedom in the public sphere, sexual slavery under Islam actually promoted woman's liberation. Can you imagine that? You might expect an article like that in the New York Times, and there have been plenty of them. An article published in the New York Times recently has likened the sexual slaves conniving for power in the harem to the struggles of Western women in the corporate world. There have been a lot of efforts to downplay the phenomenon of massive slavery in the Islamic Empire. And these academics have had to dance quite a dance. And to conceal what it really was, many academics have written marvels of ingenuity,
obscuring the truth.
Thus defending slavery in the Islamic Mamluk Empire,
one medieval studies professor offers this, which is a pretty standard view among academics of this issue.
It is important to understand, he wrote, that medieval Islamic civilization had a different attitude towards slavery than that seen in Western Europe's. Slaves were much better treated and their status was quite honorable.
Furthermore, a variety of career opportunities were open to the skillful slave.
And to the higher standards of living available in the Islamic Middle East meant there was often little resistance but to being taken as a Mamluk.
Among the peoples of Central Asia and Southeastern Europe,
many young Turkish women, slaves and free,
also arrived,
bringing with them some of Central Asia's tradition of sexual equality. Well, in commenting on that, Juan Fernandez Moreira, the author of the book that is the basis for much of this, says this. He says, one can certainly imagine the throngs of girls and boys in Greece, Serbia, and Central Asia clamoring to be taken away from their families, to be circumcised, to become sexual slaves, or to be castrated to guard harems as eunuchs, or in other cases to be raised in barracks with the sole purpose of becoming fearless slave soldiers. One can imagine among Egyptian youth the same interest in a career as a slave, which would have made it unnecessary for Mamluk rulers in Egypt to raid foreign lands to obtain replacement slaves or to buy them at slave markets. Bernard Lewis and Daniel Pipes have pointed out that these professors have overlooked that in Islam there existed two fundamental categories of peoples, slaves and non-slaves. That is why enslaving Muslims was soon discouraged in early Islam and eventually forbidden. The existence of female slaves, usually Catholics, captured in war, bought in market, as poets, singers, dancers, physicians, and other occupations, was common throughout the Islamic world, not just in Al-Andalus. They were as common as male slaves, frequently of Catholic origin, who were used as soldiers. They dramatically shaped the history of Islam, culturally, socioeconomically, militarily, and, guess what, genetically. Most Abbasid rulers in the Middle East and all Umayyad rulers in Al-Andalus had sexual slave mothers. Many of these mothers were Caucasians. They were descendants, many of them, of Catholic Visigoths. Strangely enough, the descendant of these women, these Catholic Caucasians, were often rulers more illustrious and prestigious within the Andalusian Islamic community than the children of Muslim women. These people particularly valued blonde or redhead Franks and Galician women as sexual slaves. The physical appearance of several Spanish Muslim princes betrayed their descent from Caucasian slave mothers. Many of them had very white skin, reddish hair. Muhammad I, who reigned 852 to 866, had a pink face. Another ruler had white skin, a pink face, blue eyes, and blonde hair. There's a whole list of rulers in
Fernand Morera's book, and they often tinted their blonde hair to black to appear more Arabic to their subjects. They often darkened their skin. The Arabic sources indicate the practice of having children with Spanish Catholic women probably began when the son of Musa took as one of his several wives Queen Egilio, widow of the Visigoth King Rodrigo. As a result of the sexual intercourse with Caucasian Catholic girls, each generation of rulers saw its genetic Arab component reduced by half, so that the last ruler of the Umayyads, that's around 1013, would have had approximately 0.09% of Arabic genetic makeup. By the second generation, Arab rulers in Al-Andalus had far more European than Arab genes. This multi-generational process must have diluted dramatically the non-European genetic makeup of the general population of Al-Andalus. And you have to think that this European Catholic factor, with its presumably greater love of individual liberty and regard for the individual human being as opposed to the group, contributed to the again presumably so-called greater freedom that women enjoyed in Islamic Spain as opposed to other regions that were under Muslim rule. Let's come up to the 14th century. There's a quite famous contemporary observer, a historian, who describes the inhabitants of Granada as white-skinned. Such was the cultural impact on the Islamic Middle Ages of the Caucasian sexual slaves from Catholic lands that the Turkish word kiz, K-I-Z, meaning girl or slave girl or sexual slave girl, came to mean Catholic woman in Islamic use. Kiz is the same word for sexual slave girl and for Catholic women. That might give you a measure of the status of women under Islamic rule in Spain. You know, during this brief program, we are examining four aspects of the woman's life and condition under Muslim rule. This fourth is a most unfortunate one. And it's curiously, this cultural practice has not been pointed out in the general scholarly histories on the Islam of Al-Andalus. Even the best scholars have prudently tiptoed around it. Yet several examples easily found in contemporary legal documents make the presence of female circumcision rather clear that it was widespread. The Muslim female circumcision, the kifad, or lessening, was legal, taken for granted, and praiseworthy in Al-Andalus. The practice of female circumcision is so taken for granted in this medieval Islamic culture that it is often merely mentioned as an aside in the course of talking about something else. Would most Muslim women in Al-Andalus have been circumcised? Probably they were. How many fathers and mothers do not want their little girl to grow up to be an honorable woman in a society where female circumcision is considered honorable? And how many little girls would have the physical strength or conviction to refuse circumcision in a society where every little girl goes through this rite of passage? That's all the time we have, and I realize we need a part two to this program because there's more to say on this subject. So look for that program. It's coming very soon. This is BreadboxMedia.com. Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight.